Well, we're talking about change, if you hadn't figured that out by now. But before we begin, I want to do a little experiment with you. Right now, without thinking about it a whole lot, change two things about yourself. All righty. How many of you removed something? How many of you picked up something? Okay, a few. We tend to think of, when somebody says change something, we tend to start shedding things, shoes, glasses, bracelet, watch, whatever, earring. We did this exercise in ministerial school. We were seated at tables and there was some paper for us to write on the table, and then the lady said, change three things about yourself, and we started taking stuff off, and she said, nobody picked up the paper on the table. It didn't enter anybody's mind that change could be a positive thing. So, and yet we know that it can. We've heard over and over again that change is the only constant. It is ubiquitous. And it can be relative because, like with Kathleen, the change for her is, for the most part, a wonderful, exciting, positive thing. And we're thinking, oh, gee, we're glad for you, but we're going to miss you. So change is relative. We know that our bodies are constantly changing. I think we have a new liver every so many months, a whole new body every 7 years. So we are creatures of change. And when we resist it, we're going against our very nature. We look at change as good or bad, and that's okay, but there's so much more to it than that. The paradox of change is that we long for it. We want better health, more money, better relationships, more focused spirituality, but at the same time, we dread change because it's that unknown. We don't know what's going to be required of us if things change. So we dread it, and in some cases, we curl up into little balls and insulate ourselves from it. There's an old, old saying that says, the fates lead those who will. Those who won't, they drag. So change is inevitable, and you might as well go into it with a song in your heart, and you pick the song. Miss Charles Fillmore, the co-founder of Unity, said that if he had not named the school Unity School of Christianity, he would have named it Unity School of Change, because that's what we're about changing. How many of you know the Serenity Prayer? Okay, join me in saying it together. God, grant me the serenity to change the things I can't accept, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. There's a corollary to that you may or may not have heard, but it really speaks to me. It's, God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know it's me. Change only begins with us when we are able to honestly and wholeheartedly say, I realize that I'm part of the problem. As long as we are putting the problem out there and saying it's his fault, her fault, their fault, I was an innocent bystander, nothing's going to happen. We're just going to spin around in the same rut. And that's not a happy way to live our lives. Two men were at a 25th reunion. They knew one another. And one of them pointed across the room and he says, see that guy over there? Yeah. He's gotten so fat and bald he doesn't even recognize me. So we're told by some New Thought writers that we need to become spiritual warriors And I always found that expression a little bit off-putting because I don't like to think of warriors. But until I realized that we're not, in our case at any rate, our focus isn't on fighting the devil or evil or even others. Our warriorhood is against our own tendency towards denial and defensiveness and dishonesty in our own personality. We all lie to ourselves. And we can keep doing that forever and we won't change. But when we dare to open up and speak truth, we will be different. We've heard the phrase, change your mind, change your life. It's been in religious science, daily, monthly books forever. And quantum physics has proven that thoughts are indeed things. And I'm not going to go into it because I couldn't do it adequately. But if you saw the movie last Saturday, The People Versus a State of Illusion, they make it pretty clear. And if you have not seen that, I heartily recommend that you get a copy because it has an hour and a half of bonus material, which is talking with the individual scientists that are featured here and there throughout the film. And it's just mind-blowing, and it will change you if you watch it. There was, back in the 80s, before Detroit collapsed, the big auto manufacturers would take themselves on junkets to Europe or wherever to look at other auto manufacturing facilities, and they took one to Japan. And they toured this plant that, of course, it was impeccable, and it was new, and everything was beautiful about it. And they came home, and someone asked them, well, how was the plant? And they said, it wasn't a real plant. It wasn't a real plant. Well, how can you say that? How could they fabricate, you know, a pretend plant? Well, it wasn't a real plant because there was no inventory. And the plant that they were touring was operating under a new concept called lean manufacturing, which meant that they didn't carry an inventory. They brought the supplies in when they had an order to fill. And they did not tie up their money or space in hanging on to inventory that they didn't know when they were going to use. So it was very efficient, it was innovative, it was cost effective. But the Americans didn't even see that. They saw no inventory, it's not a real plant. And what their problem was, they had no curiosity. No one asked, well, why is there no inventory? They just saw that it was not there and that cut off their thought processes. And that's unfortunate, but sometimes we do that. In the movie, People Versus a State of Illusion, which you can obtain by going stateofillusion.com. There's one experiment that they show where they took a robot, which was essentially a canister, and they put it in this enclosure, which was just a wooden floor. It was probably 10 by 12 feet or maybe a little less. And it had a little short wall on it, maybe 6 or 8 inches. And this little canister robot was programmed to move randomly. And it did. They had, you know, graphs and tracings of its weird movements back and forth and all around. And it covered the whole place pretty much, but you had no idea where it was going to go next. And then they introduced a clutch of eggs that was ready to hatch, put them by the robot, and they hatched. And baby chicks and I think other fowl I forget what the word is, but they will imprint on whatever is there and think it's their mother. So these baby chicks imprinted on the robot. And then they took the chicks out and put them in an adjacent enclosure. They couldn't get to the robot, but they could see it, and it could see them. After that, the robot did its random movements only on the side of the enclosure that was closest to the baby chicks. So the baby chicks, looking for mama, influenced an inanimate object to come to them, essentially. Now, if baby chicks, which probably have brains the size of a pencil eraser, can do that, think of what we can do. I mean, we're the ones with the big brains. We have infinite, vast potential. And it's time in the history of our world that we started using that potential for something other than complaining about what's going on and not doing anything about it. There is a woman named Lynn McTaggart who wrote a book a few years back called The Field, and it's about that quantum field, that web of energy, and I want to read to you a couple of paragraphs. But the most astonishing implication of the new physics concerns the role of human intention, its ability to shape our world, and its central role in the nature of reality. Quantum theory suggests that reality is not fixed, but fluid or mutable, and hence open to influence, and that we, as influencers, are central to this entire process. The latest scientific research proves that every thought we have is a tangible energy. Hear that. Every thought we have is a tangible energy, an energy that can actually be measured as a surge of electrical voltage that changes the molecular structure of the object of our intentions. It changes our thought, change the molecular structure of what we're thinking about. Our thoughts, our hopes, desires, wishes have an independent energy that transforms the nature of the world. And this is not, you know, just one person idly speculating. This is what they're proving. This was written, like I said, about around 2003, I'm guessing. So let's go back to about 60 years. To Charles Fillmore, the co-founder of Unity. Modern metaphysicians have discovered that with every thought we think, there is a movement of active forces. Not only a movement of those forces, but a movement of everything connected with our consciousness, our body, our world. Every time we speak, we cause the atoms and cells of our body to tremble and go through certain changes. Not only do we cause the cells and atoms of our body to form new adjustments, but we even affect the cells of the bodies of those with whom we associate. So Mr. Fillmore, who was pretty uneducated formally, was 60 years ahead of quantum physics. So it all comes together. We live in a web of interconnected energy, and our thoughts make a difference not just to ourselves, but to all of creation. There is a story I've told before, and I want to share it again because we learn by repetition, and it's a lovely story. It's from Maya Angelou, and it's about a woman named Annie in 1903 in Arkansas. Annie was a married woman with two little children, two little toddlers. She was barely literate. She could read a little bit. She could add a little bit. And according to Maya Angelou, to this picture add a disastrous marriage and the burdensome fact that Mrs. Johnson was a Negro. She told her husband, Mr. William Johnson, of her dissatisfaction. And he conceded that he too found the marriage less than he had hoped for. So they agreed to part ways. And he confessed that he had a yen to become a preacher and that he knew of a preacher in Enid, Oklahoma that would train him. And he did not tell her that he also knew that this preacher had very friendly unmarried daughter. So Mr. Johnson took what pretty much all the money they had to fund his trip to Oklahoma and left the house to Annie. Now Annie decided there and then she was not going to be a domestic. So she got to thinking, what could she do? This is 1903, and there was a cotton gin and a lumber mill within miles of where she lived, and she knew there was no chance of her ever getting hired there. But she realized that she could cook a little bit. She said, nothing fancy, but I can scare the hungry off a man. And so she formulated a plan and took a practice run where she loaded up 2 5-gallon cans with rocks and walked 5 miles to the cotton gin and unloaded some of the rocks, and then walked the next 3 miles to the lumber mill and unloaded the rest of her rocks, and then came home. So she knew she could physically do it. So she came home and started making meat pies, the pastry, the raw pastry, and chicken and ham and, you know, vegetables. And then she loaded up a brazier and the coals and everything she needed, the oil. And she went, actually it was 3 miles to the cotton gin, not that it matters a whole lot, and set up her brazier. And so just when the noon whistle rang, she dropped her pastries into the hot oil. And the men coming out, all covered with cotton fluff, had their lunches. They had beans and sardines and stuff, but they smelled this delicious smell. And so they bought her pastries at 5 cents a piece. And then she took what was left over, the cold ones, the next 5 miles to the cotton gin or the lumber mill, and sold those. The next day she switched. She did the fresh ones at the lumber mill and the cold ones at the cotton gin. She did this through a couple of years, probably, through spring, through the heat of summer, through the cold of winter, until the men expected her to be there. And then she set up a booth halfway between, and they had to come to her. And that booth eventually became a store that sold just about everything. But when she was contemplating her life after her husband left, she said, I looked up the road I was going and back the way I came, and since I wasn't satisfied, I decided to step off the road and cut me a new path. And any of us can step off the road and cut a new path. There's another kind of change, and this is the one that we needn't fear, maybe a little bit, but it's transformation. And this is when we operate according to the words of Einstein, that you cannot solve a problem at the same level of thought that caused the problem. We have to come up spiritually a step or more to be transformed. Romans 12:10 says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove the will of God and what is good and acceptable and true. And then there's the French Foreign Legion motto. Does anybody know that? If I falter, push me on. If I stumble, pick me up. If I retreat, shoot me. So we need to stop rehearsing our fears and our supposed limitations and focus only on the good, because we have seen the power of our thoughts, not only on ourselves, but on everything. God didn't create us to live lives of quiet desperation, to just get up in the morning and do whatever it is we do during the day and come home, go back to bed, get up in the morning, do it all over again. We're not meant to live that kind of mediocrity. We're meant to be people of transformation. And you may be thinking, well, okay, I'm 85 years old. I don't have any aspirations to be Steve Jobs or somebody like that. Well, you don't have to be. You can be a transformative person without ever getting out of your chair or bed if you just uplift your spirit. If you just take that time to pray, to meditate, if you just take the time to focus your thoughts on positive things, and when the negative thoughts come up, just, I'm not dealing with that. Just not going to entertain you. Go away. Set your intention for transformation. Carlos Castaneda said, intent is a force that exists in the universe. When sorcerers, and by sorcerers, he means those who are living from source with a capital S. When sorcerers beckon intent, it comes to them and sets up the path for attainment, which means that sorcerers always accomplish what they set out to do. We are sorcerers, we just don't know it. We've got linear time, which is the time on the calendar. We've got cyclical time, which is the changing of the seasons. And then we have crucial time, which is where intention meets time. And this is the only place that anything happens. The crucial time is now. It's always now. When we are not living in this now moment, we're not really living. And we're not making appropriate decisions about our life. If we're fussing about what happened 40 years ago, or if we're worrying about what might happen coming up the road, we need to step off and cut ourselves a new path. In crucial time, miracles happen. In crucial time, we manifest our intentions. Your transformation is only a thought away. Let us pray. Precious Spirit, give us the strength, the grace, the willingness, the mind of a little child to be open to the transforming power of your life and love. You have created us to become Christed beings. We're tired of sitting and waiting for things to change. We need to step in with our intention and make it happen. Thank you, God. Amen.